morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Catherine Donovan, who's the director of Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And we're also going to be speaking to two residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute, who are doing extraordinary work over there. Right now, I would like to welcome Judith Newton. She is the author of the children's book Nito Meets Chloe, The Continuing Tale of an Assistance Dog of the West. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, this is the second in a series of dogs. Is this really a series? Do you have a whole...
Well, we're certainly hoping it's a series. We have our next one planned, which will be Nito going to Paris. And, of course, we'll be delighted to go over there and do some homework.
Oh, that's tough work, but I guess you got to do it. Now, Assistance Dogs of the West, let's hear a little bit about them. What is an assistance dog? I think probably a lot of Santa Feans have seen them around, but it's not the same as, for example, a guide dog.
No, these are dogs that help people with physical disabilities, often emotional disabilities, and often seizure problems. So, but they are not dogs for the blind.
And so these dogs are trained to do what kinds of activities?
These dogs are trained to help people in their home, whether it's picking up something, whether it's closing a door, which is what my dog loves to do. But also they act as a social conduit. For many people have been kept in their homes, particularly young people, and afraid to go out and face the public. But the dog acts as a wonderful nurturing and also a wonderful thing for people to come up and talk and feel very comfortable with. And we take them into the schools. And we also have programs in the detention center and in a vocational center so that young people learn to train the dogs. And then they are given to the person who is in need.
Now, the dog Nito and the little girl Chloe, are they real people or are they made-up characters?
Nito is quite made up, but he has become sort of part of our lives. Sue Blackburn and I feel very fondly about him.
Sue Blackburn, your illustrator.
My illustrator, who is wisely perhaps in Mexico at this point. Otherwise, she certainly would like to be here. Chloe, I named the little girl Chloe because she's the fourth granddaughter that I have, and sort of an unexpected gift. And she now thinks, Chloe thinks she's famous, but I don't want to disillusion her.
Well, the little girl Chloe in the book is in a wheelchair. Do a lot of people, well, especially children who are in wheelchairs or disabled in one way or another, get assistance dogs?
Many of them do, as many as we can, and many of them, they have to apply. There's quite a waiting list, although our organization is able to provide a dog much faster than most national organizations or organizations in other places.
Really? Why is that?
Because we have a tremendous team for training the dog. We have the professionals, but then we have all these students in schools who are helping. And that sort of alleviates one of the steps. And so they get a faster training period, and they're ready to go. And as you probably know, we have a graduation every year. The last 2 years have been at the Lenzic Theater, and it's at that time...
Do they let dogs into the Lenzic?
They do if they have their vests on, because these service dogs are allowed by law everywhere and anywhere.
So these dogs are trained by students, not only professional trainers, but students at Desert Academy.
Desert Academy, Mariposa, and then, as I said, the detention center in Albuquerque and the vocational.
And so the people
school.
In the detention center, are these young people?
These are young
juvenile
young
detention
women.
Center?
Yes.
Very interesting. Now, why is it women who are mainly the
it
dog
is
trainers?
Women. We do use, at this juncture, we go to the women's detention center.
Why is that?
I think it was probably easier for us. You know, I'm not in that part of the assistance dog, so I really can't answer that question. But
so these dogs go pretty much anywhere that regular dogs can't. And we've actually heard stories every once in a while of dogs being, assistance dogs being unwelcome in restaurants.
Not in Santa Fe. In fact, the other day I was at Ginger and Chutney was sitting under the table.
Now, Chutney is here in the Santa Fe Baking Company and is an assistance dog who is hearing her name.
And getting up to get her piece of cheese. And the manager very sweetly came and put her tail under her so she wouldn't trip anyone although she was quite under the table at the time. But, yes, they are allowed anywhere, and that is a federal law. In fact, you'll see them on airplanes, and you'll see them everywhere. And certainly in Santa Fe, when you see a dog with a red vest, you know it's an assistance dog of the West.
Now, how are they like pets, and how are they not like pets?
It's a fine line. It's a little bit like children, you know. One moment.
How are they like pets?
Well, one moment you have to be strict and make them do what they're supposed to do, and the other moment you let them on the couch and cuddle in your lap.
So you actually have an assistance dog which had flunked the original assistance dog training.
Yes, the technical word is she was released from the program, and she was released from the program because she was fairly quite shy and somewhat skittish. And we've had her for 6 years, and I realized that she remembered all of the commands, and they learned 90 commands. And then I began to have a physical problem and thought, well, we'll try this again. And so we self-trained, which means that I trained her along with a professional in a class. And she finally passed with flying colors, so she's official.
What kind of things does she do for you?
Well, she closes all my cabinet doors, whether I want them closed or not. She picks up anything that I drop. When we're out, she provides a sort of a stabilizing. I can hold on to her if I feel that I'm losing some kind of balance.
So balance problems are a lot more real than people who don't have them can possibly imagine.
It's unpleasant. It is unpleasant. But you get used to it, and you sort of, I can sense it. So I grab.
And the dog doesn't fall.
The dog does not fall.
So tell us more about the book, which is very cute in rhymed verse with lovely, sweet illustrations. Why are you doing this series?
Because we feel so strongly about the program. And our first book, which was Nito, a story of a service dog, sort of inspired us to go on. We were so impressed with the training that these dogs get. And then once we had written the first book, how could we possibly not do a second book? Because Nito had to find a family, and it just flowed for both of us, both Sue and for me.
And so it goes on from here, and next Paris, perhaps after that Beijing.
That's a thought too, a little bit in the future, I think.
Well, anything else that you want to tell our audience about?
Yes, I would like to say that these books are, first of all, the books cost $12, and all the money goes to the assistance dog. So it's a total charity, volunteer work on the part of Sue and me. And they can get the books at Collected Works, and we at 208 West San Francisco Street. And we had a reading there by Ali McGraw, which was just a delight. And also they can get it by calling the ADW office, which is 986-9748. Or on the web, it's assistancedogsofthewest.org. And, of course, we want to sell out because that way we can go to Paris.
Wonderful. Well, Judith Newton is the author of the children's book Nito Meets Chloe, the continuing tale of an assistance dog of the West, illustrated by Sue Blackburn. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Catherine Donovan. She is the director of Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, which is at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and actor Nate Patras, who is in this play. Welcome.
Thanks. Good morning.
Now, Agatha Christie we think of as a mystery novel writer.
Right.
But she actually wrote this for the stage.
She did. She actually wrote several stage plays. And this one started out as a radio play, and then she expanded it for the stage. And it's been running continuously for 55 years in London.
Is that right?
Yes.
You mean like Cats or something?
Exactly,
it's
it's
Cats the longest of London. Yeah.
The longest continually running show, I think, on record.
Very interesting. So what made you decide to stage this play here?
Well, actually, the Playhouse wanted to do the play, and they didn't have a director for it. And my daughter, Megan O'Loughlin, and I were looking for something to do together. And so they asked us if we'd be interested in directing the Mousetrap. And when I read it, I'd seen it maybe 30 years ago or so in Chicago. And I reread it and really liked it, so we decided to do it.
So this is a murder mystery set in an English inn that has just opened, run by a young couple that are very quickly in over their heads.
Right. They have a string of very curious guests that that come in.
One of whom is played by Nate Patras.
Right.
That's all right.
Now, what are you supposed to be, Italian?
I'm Parvettini, yes. I play the Italian, the foreigner. I don't know if they ever even say that I'm specifically Italian, but yeah, I play the Italian Parvettini, and very mysterious and made up with a lot of makeup and a mustache all twisted up. And so I'm one of the mysterious characters who could have done it.
Yes, and so the stage is full of people who could have done it, and I actually went to the rehearsal last night and only saw the first act, so I don't know who done it.
That's good, that's good. And a lot of people at intermission, you hear a lot of people talking about, do you think it's this one, do you think it's that one? So it really does kind of keep people guessing for a long time.
Well, that's one of the great things about mysteries is reading at about halfway through trying to figure out how much you really know and where the clues are.
Right. And, you know, of course, everyone has suspicion thrown on them in one way or another. So it really could be any of these characters.
Now, what are the challenges of staging an English play? I mean, certainly you have to work on accents. Well, you've got your Italian accent going, but...
Yeah, which was his own challenge, because everyone else is like, yes, sir, hip-ho, pip-pip, you know, cheerio, and I'm, hey, how do you doing? You know, and so I had to be in contrast with everyone else, but they certainly had a lot more difficult work, because there are certain syllables, certain words like after, and, you know, which... are very easily Americanized. So the whole cast worked really hard and continues to just sharpen this. And I'm very impressed by how well the accents have come out. You know.
Now, this isn't something that you could sort of transplant into as a period piece in America at that time.
Well, maybe you could, but I don't think it would have quite the same feel to it. You know, there's just something very British about the whole thing.
Yes.
About particularly the very exacting older lady who thinks nothing is proper.
Yes, Virginia Hall Smith is just wonderful as Mrs. Boyle. And
you'll love to hate her.
You love to hate her.
I hated her by 15 minutes into the show.
And she does get killed at the end of the first act. So.
Oh, don't! I can't believe you told them that.
Oh, that's all right. There are two murders in the show. One which takes place before the action begins and is referred to, and then there's the one that happens on stage.
So why is it called The Mousetrap?
The theme song, I guess, of the murderer is Three Blind Mice. So from that she extrapolated The Mousetrap.
How do you create an ominous sense on stage and keep that underlying dark tension going, which is the feature of all mystery stories?
Well, part of it is through the acting, and a big element in this one was Skip Rappaport's lighting design. He really did a wonderful job of kind of creating that dark, foreboding feel with the lighting. So I really take my hat off to him. He was a huge part of it.
Now, this has already opened.
Yes, we opened last week.
And it runs until?
December 30th.
The 30th, mm-hmm. At the Santa Fe Playhouse. Weekends only?
Thursday through Saturday at 8 and Sundays at 2.
And that's the Santa Fe way.
Yes.
Sundays at 2. Now, it's really an ensemble cast. I mean, there's no star of the show.
Right, very much an ensemble cast. And a really great cast. I was so pleased to find all these people.
We have a couple new actors.
We have a couple of brand new actors
who are just fabulous and have already kind of integrated into the very small acting community, it seems. And we're all having a great time backstage and really appreciating one another. So it is a really great ensemble. And I thank Catherine for putting that together, because it really is a good feeling backstage. You know.
We're talking about The Mousetrap, Agatha Christie's play that is at the Santa Fe Playhouse through the 30th of December. You like crime? You like crime dramas?
I am a big fan of the true crime genre.
Like Cold Case, like, and that kind of stuff.
Yes,
on TV.
And you know, I'm a, my husband jokes that I'm a big fan of serial killers.
But in a manner of speaking.
Yes. I read a lot of true life crime. My mother, though, was a big fan of the mystery genre. In fact, she had a lot of Agatha Christie books around the house. So I was kind of exposed to it at a young age.
And that's actually the thing that I probably read the most of during my entire junior high school years is Agatha Christie novels.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And there's something about sitting there being terrified, and you cannot rip yourself away from the book.
Right. Yeah, it does. It keeps you engaged, and there's always something new happening, and you really have to keep your mind, you know, try to keep your mind one step ahead of what's going on.
Yes. It's like a little bit of candy. It draws you in. It pulls you a little bit closer each time. Yeah.
Except you don't have a stomachache when you're done. So this is very much of a winter play, too. The police, or whatever they're called, lieutenant, whatever he is trudging through the snow, coming up on skis, and
right.
they're really snowbound.
Right. In the first act, there's as they're arriving, there's this big blizzard, and they are snowbound. There's no way to get out, and he actually skis onto the scene.
It would be like Santa Fe last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Last year around this time.
Yeah.
Yes.
A little later. So we don't want to give away too much of the play. What else do you want to say about it without telling us things that would help us solve the crime before we're there?
Can you think of anything that you want to...
Well, just I encourage everyone to come and see it. As we've put a lot of time. You know, we've been working on this show for about 7 or 8 weeks now. And
how do you do that? I mean, how do you get everybody together for a rehearsal? I think that's one of the hardest things in this town.
It is one of the hardest things. We have a cast of 8, and of course, everybody has, you know, jobs and lives. So you know, putting together a rehearsal schedule is very challenging. It's probably the most challenging part of directing here. But everybody was extremely cooperative and, you know, really kind of bent their schedules to work.
You got to believe in it, and you got to really love doing it. And once you get involved in it, it has its own tractor feel, and it makes you want to go to rehearsals despite the fact that you've already had a long day. And it, you look forward to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even though we're all volunteering our time, it is something that we're all very excited about, and we look forward to our own growth through the process. And I think everyone has taken some people with their accents, but we're all working together really well, which is nice.
My brain.
I just want to say one thing about Nate. When I read the play, and I read the part of Parravicini, Nate immediately came to my mind.
Yes.
I said, that's a Nate Patras part. So I was really, really...
Mustache whack.
Are you Greek?
No, you know, my last name makes a lot of people think that I'm Greek, but it's actually short for Petruskus, which is Lithuanian.
Uh-huh.
But I am... I was born in Italy, actually, so and I'm a quarter Italian. And my parents spent the first 2 years of being married in Italy. So we were the house on the block when I grew up in Pittsburgh. We all had dinner at 7:30, while all my friends had dinner at 5:30, and we were most definitely the loudest house on the block. So I say that I grew up with the gypsies who never moved, you know?
Right.
And so this was perfect for me. I mean, I found my grandfather in this role, you know. He'd drive his old dump truck down the road and yell at the neighbors, hey, how you doing, you know, and so...
Do you get cast in sort of ethnic parts like that?
I'm definitely a character actor. I've come to accept that. Either ethnic parts or very odd or roles and things like that. And that's good for me. They're all very fun parts.
I think character actor is probably one of the better things to be as opposed to, you know, bimbo or...
Ingenue. It's just so...
Yeah, that's true. Probably women get stereotyped. Is that... In acting, do women just get stereotyped into sort of dumb typecasting roles?
Yeah, I think all actors tend to get stereotyped depending on, you know, a lot of it has to do with physical appearance. But I find as I'm growing older that I really enjoy the parts I'm doing now much more because they're richer. I enjoy doing character roles. There just seems to be so much more meat to them than the kind of fluffy light ingenue things that I got when I, in my younger days.
So you decided not to act in this one?
No, I can't. I can't act and direct at the same time.
Some people do.
I know some people do. I don't have that kind of brain.
It's a very difficult because when you're directing, you're really like an audience member with taste. You know, you got to be able. And if you're on the stage, it's just impossible to play that role.
Yeah, you have to be able to stand back and really look at what is happening on stage as a whole. And it's difficult to do that and be involved in the acting process as well.
So The Mousetrap is Agatha Christie's drama, which is at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and it already opened, and it's Thursday through Saturdays at 8 o'clock, and then Sundays at 2 o'clock.
That's right.
Sunday is pay what you can as well.
Yay.
So if you, you know, $15 is a little steep for some people at this time of year, so what they do the Sundays, matinees, they'll allow everyone an opportunity to come see the show.
And it's a family-friendly show, too.
Yes.
I mean, the kids would enjoy this.
My daughter's seen it, like, what, 3-4
yeah.
times?
Yeah.
So no foul language, just murder.
Just one little murder.
Fashion, family, wholesome murder.
Yeah. And it's done very tastefully, I must say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
blood.
In the rehearsal last night, I saw somebody, I don't know if it was really the guy who done it, but I saw somebody, you know, coming onto the stage and strangling the horrible mean lady and then running off. But
it's done in dark, so all you see is shadow.
Uh-huh.
And you know, of course, hearing a little gurgling.
Well, gurgling and much, much more at the Santa Fe Playhouse at 142 East of Vargas Street in Santa Fe. The number over there is 988-4262. And you can also go to santafeplayhouse.org. Catherine Donovan and Nate Patras, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You.
We're going to take a little break now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with the folks from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome the folks from the Santa Fe Art Institute, and first we are speaking to Beverly Gordon. She's a professor of design studies at the University of Wisconsin, and she's a resident of the Santa Fe Art Institute, which has an open house today at 5:30 for people to come and see what's going on there. Welcome.
Hello.
So you're a scholar and an artist. You teach design history and material culture. What does that even mean, material culture?
Well, sometimes it's used by different audiences a little bit differently, but the quick and dirty way I like to define it is that it's a way of studying culture through the parts that take a material form. So everything that we actually produce, whether by hand or manufactured, is part of our material culture. And so when one studies it, it's a way of getting at the culture by looking at products. And that's done by archaeologists, it's done by historians, it's done by designers, and
yeah, I mean, for archaeologists, that's pretty much all they've got.
That's right.
For us, like if you were if you were to study contemporary United States material culture.
Which we do, yeah.
But it's so huge.
Well, of course, and you don't do it all together, but you could go in and be looking at things like the design of what's going on in cemeteries and how are people doing their mourning artifacts, just as a example that popped into my head.
What are some of the examples that you study?
Well, I've been looking at things like meanings of collecting has been one of the things that have come at from different ways. And so when people collect anything, even if it's stupid little Care Bears or if it's something that's very expensive, sometimes the meanings of what they collect are not dependent on the intrinsic value of the object. So,
what are some of the more unusual things that you've seen people collecting?
Oh, you name it, it's there. There are even museums about just about everything. Well, museums about light bulbs.
There are people who collect old light bulbs.
There are, but not just old light bulbs. Every different imaginable light bulb. Or there is a mustard museum, which is also something of a commercial enterprise, but everything about mustard that could ever be found. So, I mean, that's part of what makes human beings so fascinating. It's just that when someone does something like that and gets a quirky collection, it differentiates them. It makes them special. They have something that's theirs, and they get passionate about it. They meet people through it. It has meanings, and they may arrange things so they have aesthetic meanings, and it's socially a way into other people, and they may have to do research. So it's giving them, you know, their mind something. So we can look at the way those things matter to people across a range.
Now, is collecting, I mean, it seems to me that collecting weird, quirky, sort of in themselves meaningless things is somehow very archetypically American. Is that true?
It's not exclusively American. We have the most stuff, so we may do it the most, but it's done in other places. And, you know, these vernacular art environments that are made with cast-offs, that's a worldwide phenomenon. So we don't hold it any kind of monopoly on that.
So you are both a scholar and an artist. You're and doing and teaching both things at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, I'm less teaching the studio part of the art, although it gets in there too.
So what are you actually working on these days?
Well, I have kind of multiple tracks, and so it's always difficult to define myself. But As I've been here, I have been doing poetry that is responding to things that I'm taking in Santa Fe, including, for example, at the Art Institute, there's the exhibition by
Juan Manuel Echevarria.
Exactly. And so something that's a reaction to part of that. And I've been seeing a lot about Hispanic retablos and bultos and some reactions to that. Reactions or processing is probably a better word. So that's part of what I've been doing, is these poems that are a way of processing what I'm looking at and encountering, and I've been looking a lot and encountering a lot.
Have you spent much time in the Southwest?
I have spent several visits in different times previously, never at this time of year, but there's always so much more.
Yeah, it's interesting to I guess, observe people's reactions who don't live here to what is for us daily life, the culture of this place. Do you have any poems that you'd like to read?
I could read a poem. I could read a poem that, since we just mentioned it, I could read the poem that has to do with the exhibition. So if you'd like. Okay. So this is unusual in that the words and the images really come from a piece by Juan Manuel Echevarria very directly. I actually sat down and wrote it down. There were audio interviews, and I actually sat and wrote down their words because it was so moving to me that I wanted to have that to work from. I'm just looking for my glasses, so
yes.
People on the radio are waiting, but they're coming to read it. So this literally comes from that. It's not full-blown out of my head in any way. And the story is based on a piece he has called La Maria, which were interviews with people who had survived a guerrilla kidnapping in 2000 in Colombia. And I just found it quite intense. So the title is How to Survive a Kidnapping. Taken from the church at the moment of elevation, taken to the mountains, aimlessly moving for 5 months, certainly pointless the forced march of exiles holding exiles through the elements, andale, andale, so cold, so tired, lonely, they learned to roar. Meeting the dawn with sadness because it was the same, more marching, more cold, more of the waiting, they learn to see the signs, heart-shaped constellations, linked hearts, and yellow birds that followed every day, the little seeds of insects, iridescent helicopters that blanketed the world, the colored rocks that painted rivers, those very stones they learned to carve to make more beauty, shooting stars, waterfalls were with them. They learned to roar. Full as the forest, loud with free-flown spirit, and holy, the insides of beauty, the birds always following, insects, butterflies, stones. They learn to roar, to see deeper than human anguish, to join with the creatures, to roar and roar.
Beverly Gordon here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. She's one of the residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute who will be reading from her work and speaking to the public tonight at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute on the College of Santa Fe campus. You're working on a book on textiles.
Yes, I'm pretty much polishing the book right now, so it's in a whole form.
What's it about?
And well, it's called The Fiber of Our Lives, Why Textiles Matter, and that's what it's about. It's why do textiles matter, because I've been hearing all my life, hearing or seeing people shrug their shoulders and thinking that's sort of not terribly important, and I realized that textiles are a thread that, and one always gets these sort of inadvertent double entendres or puns when one talks about this, but they have been holding together human life since there's been any kind of human community, from the very earliest days when people made string and learned to survive by making nets, for example, or things to carry babies, to our most up-to-date, futuristic, biomedical uses of fibers in modern surgery, heart surgery, and things of that. So my book is about the whole world. It's almost boundaryless, although it has a structure, and about the role that fiber plays. And it is something that's with us from birth to death. We are wrapped in a blanket, immediately put in diapers. We wipe off the fluids that come off us when we're born. Goes through us with us every day until we die. We are wrapped in cloth too, and everything in between, in terms of cultures around the world having social rituals at every rite of passage that have to do with fabric, literally cementing it. We can talk about metaphor and myth, and there's so many phrases, the fabric of our lives, the social fabric, et cetera, et cetera. The ties that bind. You know, I've collected a lot of these. And so in every language, there are myths that show how important that is. And creating textiles is essentially linked in a metaphoric way, rather universally, to creating life. So you make something.
And some people, it's the central metaphor of their being. I read a book about the Kogi people of northeastern Colombia, and their entire theology is based on the metaphor of the warp and the weft.
Yes, yes, I've heard that, although I'm not very familiar with them. Yes, and so writing this is really, there were millions of things to be choosing. The hardest part, of course, was organizing it and deciding how do you do it so that it's not just a series of facts, but things that really stay with people.
What did you learn through doing this that moved you?
Oh, that's a hard question. I've learned so many things. I mean, I had done this because I've been thinking and teaching and writing about this for a long time, and someone asked me actually to give what he called an inspirational speech about why textiles matter, and I had to come up with a structure that I thought was going to stay with people more than individual things. So it wasn't like it was brand new, but every time I would look anything up, I would learn yet more. I knew that there were deities in some cultures that were the ones who created the world, who were also the weaving deities or the string deities. And then I would discover that so many cultures have that. Textiles were implicit in the slave trade, which affected the economy of the United States. They were implicit in why did Britain take over places like India and Nigeria, because of their textiles. Textiles used to be like oil, wealth, and easily transported, easily traded, stockpiled. So it just goes on and on. So I think what stuck with me is how I never would run out of more and more and more incredible stories.
It's interesting because people who I know, people who've majored in fiber arts, artists when they're in school, and it seems like fiber arts have a lower place than, say, bronze sculpting or egg tempera or oil painting.
That's true. There is a hierarchy, and it has to do with hard and soft and women's work. I mean, that hasn't always been true. It's not true in every culture, but it's certainly in the West or post-Renaissance. It's very much been considered a craft. And because it has been very primarily associated with women, that has changed the way its status has been. And it's a long gender story.
Is that, as we move into a more gender-equal society, is that changing?
I don't really think so. Although it's, I mean, speaking of fibroids, today there's a whole a generation of sort of, I don't even know what to call them, but sort of a new generation of in-your-face, sassy sort of feminists who have turned to things like Stitch and Bitch, which is a knitting group, and, you know, taking that in a very kind of fun way that doesn't necessarily follow any old rules. But whether that's really changing, it's hard to say.
Well, Beverly Gordon, thank you so much for talking to us. And you will be reading from your work and speaking to people tonight from 5:30 on at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Right. Thank you.
Let's turn now to Julian Rubenstein. He's a journalist. He's the author of the book Ballad of the Whiskey Robber, a true story of bank heists, ice hockey, Transylvanian pelt smuggling, moonlighting detectives, and broken hearts. He's been published in many publications, The Washington Post, Sports Illustrated, The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and many others. And his book was named Borders 2004 Original Voices Nonfiction Book of the Year, and was a finalist for many other awards. And he's in Santa Fe, also doing a residency at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
How's it going? Thanks.
Good, good. So tell us, let's talk a little bit about this book, The Ballad of the Whiskey Robber. Tell us the story of Attila Ambrus.
Attila, well, first, I have to say, do you ever ask anyone just to, like, stop their cars and start honking or anything like that on the radio?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm just not like that.
You're not like that.
Anyway, you don't get to ask questions.
I'm allowed to ask a question. I'm sure the ratio will be different. But, no, I ask it because of what I'm working on now and what I was up until the middle of the night doing. I guess we can talk about the whiskey robber first.
Well, what were you up until the middle of the night doing?
Working on my novel, which I think is about, you know, the sense of responsibility of all Americans today and what led me to it. It's the thinking about that very thing, about national character and identity and who we are and where we are and our place in this country right now. And the reason I asked you that is about thinking about the power of citizenry and the word, the spoken word, and you know, at what point people have to decide when it's their responsibility to do something. Not that it's their responsibility to honk, ask people to honk their horns, but it was just something I always wondered if you would be tempted to do.
It never even occurred to me.
Well,
tell us more about your novel.
Well, it's called American Martyr, and it's about this. It's a story of two journalists who the narrator and his friend who and the question at the center of the book is whether or not the narrator's friend becomes involved in a domestic terrorism organization that ultimately carries out an attack in the U.S. And I think it is a lot about the question of national character and identity, the thin line between guilt and innocence, and sort of the nature of truth, betrayal, and obligation. And it's a story that sort of really just overtook me, and I was under contract to do another book, but instead I basically was plunged into this, and it's one of the reasons.
Well, by the invisible forces, or
yes, definitely. It was a story I couldn't escape, and that I knew almost felt like I knew in a flash, even though it's a very intricate story. Feels like from one moment to the next, suddenly it just was living inside me, and I knew the whole thing as if it was my own. So I just embarked on that, and last night I was up late, as I have been the last several nights this week, trying to get it in to my editor. So
I've often wondered how a young American writer like you can write stories about domestic terror organizations. I mean, how do you know how people speak and think and what they do, who you presumably have not really been closely involved with, or maybe you have?
Well, I mean, you know, I've worked as a journalist for 15 years. I've traveled all over the world doing stories, and I think it's that invaluable experience that enables me to do it. But I think another thing that's sorely lacking in journalism, and journalism is definitely a major theme in this story, is heart these days and empathy. And I think it's part of the disconnect that's happened in the aftermath of 9/11 and what in the book I call aftershock, what Naomi Klein has called the shock doctrine. I think that it's, you know, partly something instinctive and also partly something about paying attention and caring and noticing things, you know. And if you have the opportunities that I've had to be in a lot of other countries and witness a lot of other things and just read a lot and talk to people, I think that hopefully hopefully you can pick some of that up, and I think that's what happened with me.
Have you written much fiction before?
Nope, never.
Your last, the book you wrote, The Ballad of the Whiskey Robber, that's a true story of a very interesting character who I saw in a film that you made, a short film that is on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
He's a professional, a former professional ice hockey goalie.
Yeah. That story, you know, what I mentioned at the beginning, this connection of national character and identity, which led me to this new book, it's really at the heart of this, of the book that you're talking about now. And it's a theme, an issue I've been interested in for a long time. And what the story of this guy, what was so interesting about it, and I'll get to specifics in a second, is just how he came to embody an entire people and an entire era. And that's what just blew me away about how, I mean, it was, I always say, and it's I probably is going to be the case till I die, that I'll never come across a better story again in my life. Maybe it's partly why I'm writing a novel now, although I don't think so exactly. But the story is about this guy who became known as the Whiskey Robber. He became a national hero in Hungary after the fall of communism. During the 1990s, he was robbing banks and sort of out. Outrageous fashion and handing flowers to tellers, mailing wine to investigators, and he was out swimming police through the Danube River after these robberies, and he was basically hitting only state-owned banks, and it became a real comment on the frustration of, and embodied the frustration of the people with their with this changeover to capitalism and democracy that was so disappointing to them in those early years and so full of corruption. And he was sort of like almost like a court jester. And it so turned out that this guy who had anonymously been, you know, robbing banks in this crazy way for 7 years turned out to be the professional hockey goalie for the biggest team in the country. He was from Transylvania. He escaped into Hungary underneath a train just before the fall of communism in 1988, and he was working as a grave digger, an animal pelt smuggler, a door-to-door pen salesman. He finally got a job driving the Zamboni for the hockey team, and then he ultimately made the rare leap up the depth chart from janitor to hockey goalie when all the money fell out of sports, when the changeover of the government happened, and ended up as the goalie, and as I say in the book, arguably the worst hockey goalie in the history of the sport, once giving up 23 goals in a single game, and was yeah, definitely a contender for the most ignominious player in history.
Why did he rob the banks?
Well, I mean, it started out, I think, I mean, at his heart, I think he's a guy who wanted so badly to belong somewhere and to prove he could be somebody. I mean, that's the whole thing that drove him all along. But, you know, at the very beginning, it was just sheer desperation. He, as I mentioned, worked all those jobs. He couldn't make a living. I mean, he tried everything. He had come from Romania, where in Romania, as a Hungarian, he was nothing but a lowly Hungarian. And then he escapes into Hungary and finds even there, then he's considered nothing but a lowly Romanian, a class, a nationality he absolutely despised. So he was treated as a second-class citizen. There was huge unemployment, homelessness, and massive economic problems at that time after the changeover. And he simply wasn't able to make a living. He was deep in debt. And he basically at a crossroads in his life, he's a survivor. I mean, he would have never made it. He literally would have probably died in a Romanian prison had he not escaped. And so he basically facing a really dark and possibly no future, he decided to knock off a post office just to get out of his debts and survive. And it turned out that he definitely has an addictive personality, and it turned it out to be very easy, and he did a few more. Then the media and the people started getting very sort of enraptured by this.
Because he always did it with the flowers and...
No. But those were details that people picked up on. But he never did hurt anyone. He was polite. At first he wasn't even using a real gun. Then he started using a real gun because customers were actually one time laughing at him because they didn't believe he was actually robbing a bank. And he realized he had to be able to be convincing. But no, it just was catching on in terms of even more. People were not at that time really against the idea of robbing a bank. I mean, people felt that they themselves were being robbed blind on a daily basis by the government. It wasn't. It sort of didn't really. It was treated sort of breezily in some of the media coverage originally, and he sort of saw that this was a way, ironically, that he was able to succeed when he was having really no success in any other area of his life.
And why was he finally caught?
Well, I mean, he was caught two separate times because once he ended up escaping out of the prison on a bedsheet out of a fourth-story window. And that's when I heard of the story in 1999. It became an international news story. It was the largest manhunt in post-communist history that was launched in order to finally catch him. But the first time he was arrested, it was because of a mistake. He picked up an accomplice who was his hockey teammate who made a mistake and was captured and then gave up Attila, and then he was the second time. I'll leave some of it to hopeful readers, but he was eventually captured by this massive manhunt.
And hopeful readers, I was reading some of the press about this book, and so one person's review was, "You must go read it now. This is a command." People, it's apparently extremely very much of a page turner. Let's talk a little bit about journalism. I mean, you've written for, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, Rolling Stone, many other publications. How has journalism changed since you've gotten into it?
Well, unfortunately, it's changed a lot, I think, and not in good ways. What had been happening, you know, even then, but it's gone on even more, is the conglomeration of the media, which unfortunately has a hugely adverse effect on coverage in ways even that are invisible, because it's like, you know, if you look at the healthcare system or if you look at politics, which are so heavily connected to the money, well journalism too, and in ways that not only can't even be seen, but can't even be sort of even known or understood by people who are inside the system. It's such a system that, I mean, and then you look at, like, why do problems happen that ultimately seem more endemic than they are? Like, you look at what happened at the New York Times, the coverage leading up to the war, Judith Miller's erroneous coverage, and that, you know, it wasn't just the problem of
erroneous on purpose coverage.
Well, I'm not actually suggesting that, but I think that, and in fact, that's my point almost, is that, you know, that the system was such that she could make those huge mistakes and it not be, you know, discovered or figured out either by her or her superiors. And I mean, I just think it's a tragedy, and it's been a very, very difficult time to be a journalist, I think, in this country. Anyone who cares about the First Amendment, the Fourth Estate, why it was found, you know, it was begun in the first place, all the Jefferson's ideals, I mean, I just think it's just been really difficult. And the independent media has been, you know, stellar in a lot of ways, but you know, unfortunately, they're drowned out in many ways by the force of the mainstream media.
Just because they don't have the listenership, the readership, the viewers.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking to Julian Rubenstein. You were talking about the heart and empathy. Where do you in journalism today find that heart and empathy that you found lacking?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, I read a wide variety of things, but I mean, I to be honest, I sometimes prefer reading the British papers for daily news. I mean, I do still read the Times, but almost partly because more in terms of a conversational way to know what the Times is covering, and for myself to know what it's covering. It's almost like I'm monitoring the Times, but I don't mean to completely disparage the Times, because they do a great job in a lot of ways, but I don't think they've been a great example of journalism in recent times. But you know, I think the New Yorker has some tremendous stuff. Cy Hirsch's coverage of the military, the Department of Defense, and Iraq, as well as the other Packers coverage there. I mean, yeah, I do think occasionally Harper's. I search around for stuff because unfortunately, you know, I have written for a lot of magazines, and there's very few magazines left that I am that interested in writing for. I've been writing less for magazines and focusing more on books, where I can sort of have more freedom to tell the stories that I want. But it is hard to find that. I mean, there's lots of stories that I want to tell that are hard to find funding. And in this media climate, it's very difficult to find much space in American magazines for things that are other than Iraq, basically. And of course, Iraq is incredibly important, but there are a lot of stories that are important. So I think that to find good news coverage, you really have to, you know, put in a real effort and search it out. And there's a lot of places. I mean, there's a lot of places you might find a great story. The Nation does a lot of great stories, I think. And if you just kind of canvas it, you'll find the stuff you need. I mean, a perfect example is that leading up to the war, I mean, anyone who's reading the information that was out there clearly knew what at least Bush claimed he knew. So, you know, I mean, the information is out there, you know.
It just takes time yeah, and effort to find it.
It is a big effort, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go. You will be reading from your new book tonight, your new novel,
yeah,
which is going to be published. Is there a publication date? I mean,
No, I don't have a publication date yet. I mean, it's a little complicated just because I had the other book contract, so I'm having to iron all that stuff out. But hopefully, maybe about a year from now.
Well, Julian Rubenstein, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
And once again, the residents of the Santa Fe Art Institute will be showing and reading from their work tonight at 5:30. The Santa Fe Art Institute is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. 424-5050 is the number there, and sfai.org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Herbie Hancock. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott, speaking of the arts, as always, on Fridays, and a little bit of Christmassy stuff as well. Hasta mañana. Ciao.